Okay, good morning. So last time we were looking at the radio link, so which is what defines wireless networks, the fact that you're transmitting your data over a radio link. And so we mentioned that the equipment used to do this is antennas, and for our purposes, they transmit this sinusoidal signal and at a certain power level, and they have patterns of transmission, so they can either do it radiating equally in all directions, radiating in a plane, or sort of focusing their power in a specific direction. Okay. We then noted the key aspect of radio transmission is the fact that the power of the signal decreases as the signal travels. And so as an initial cut, you have free space loss, which says the power decreases with the distance squared. And if you are out in the middle of space with nothing else happening, that's how it works. Since we are not in space, we're in some sort of terrestrial environment, then there will be impediments to our signal, and the signal will be bouncing off objects, perhaps curving around objects. So you're not going to just get a straight path from sender to receiver. Typically what happens is that you end up with multiple paths from sender to receiver. And so this led to a discussion of various other loss models, which take those multiple paths into account. And what I said was moving on. So after this lecture, we're just going to assume that that does happen with some sort of exponential characteristic. Okay. So those large-scale fading effects are complicated enough, but then we also have small-scale fading, which happens at sort of the distance relative between the sender and receiver changes sort of by a small amount, and it's also caused by multipath and additionally then motion. Okay, and so motion can be what's causing your distance to change by a small amount, but also just through Doppler effects, motion will then cause its own problems. And we characterize those problems as either slow versus fast, so either the characteristics of the channel changed during the transmission of a single bit, or they were relatively stable over the transmission of a bit, and then either over the bandwidth of the transmission, and the characteristics were the same, or else you experience fades at selected frequencies within that bandwidth. Okay. Okay, so this led to somewhat unpredictable channel conditions, and again, depending on the fading, you're going to lose more or less of your bits. And we ended up saying, well, what can we do about this? Okay. So that's going to be the core of today's lecture, is what do you do about trying to deal with these, the unpredictable channel. So a sort of obvious thing to do is to just increase the power at which you're transmitting. Obviously, if you blast the signal out strongly enough, you're going to drop below the where you're going to drop below the fades or rise above the fades. Okay. You're still going to have large-scale effects, so that, you know, whatever you do, you're still going to have some limitations on distance. But more significantly and problematically, what if you're not the only signal in the area? So if you have multiple transmitters and receivers, then they can't, you know, essentially you can't be doing the equivalent of screaming at the top of your lungs if you all here tried to carry on conversations at your highest voice. You know that you still won't be able to hear each other. You know, there will be too much interference between neighboring conversations. Okay. So a second attempt, which, I mean, that's not to say there isn't adjustments to power. There are. A second possibility is that we adjust our modulation encoding schemes based on channel quality. And so what you can think is that, again, if you think of a base station and some mobile user, then as a rule of thumb, the closer you are to the base station, the less your power drop is going to be and the better quality of your signal. So you can fiddle around with the bit rates and the quality of the encoding. And again, the faster the bit rate, then the less time you have to recover the signal, and the more difficult it can become. But again, if you're close to your base station, then that shouldn't be much of a problem. So you use an encoding which will encode multiple bits into a single signaling element, and then you use sort of a minimal channel encoding. So you add the smallest amount of redundancy possible because you don't expect a lot of errors. Okay. And as you move out, then you want to essentially slow down your signaling rate and increase your channel encoding because you're going to expect more errors. Okay. So this is done in lots of systems. From Wi-Fi to cellular systems, just to deal with, again, more large-scale effects, the larger gross distance effects. Okay. What it does mean is that you're getting different bit rates depending where you are relative to your base station. Okay. So, those are some tricks that are used. Additionally, we can try and be a little bit more clever about our modulation techniques. And so we have a class of techniques called spread spectrum techniques, which you can really include OFDM in. And the idea with spread spectrum techniques is that you're increasing the bandwidth of your signal from a narrow band to a broad band. And this allows you to gain resistance to some of the small scale effects and sort of general noise in the system. Additional to that, we can have forms of redundancy multiple input, multiple outputs, so we can use the characteristics of these multipath channels to introduce redundancy into the system. Okay. So again, we're going to look at two sort of spread spectrum techniques. We're going to look at two modulation techniques. Our classic sort of frequency hopping spread spectrum, and that's drawn from Stallings, and then orthogonal frequency division multiplexing, which radio electronics has a fairly good tutorial for. And then, so those are attempts to come up with better modulation techniques for our signal that allow us to also avoid loss. And then MIMO, again, is going to be a technique which allows you to add redundancy into your system. And again, if you have redundancy, then you can use that redundancy to try and minimize loss. So we're going to go through the two modulation techniques and then say a few words about MIMO. We'll start with spread spectrum. It gives you sort of the idea of what we're trying to do. And who uses spread spectrum? Some local area networks, so some of the local area network standards, more modern standards have gone to using OFDM versus these older types of spread spectrum. Cellular systems use code division multiple access, and that's, again, more the 3G systems, the 4G systems, and 5 and onwards tend to go with OFDM and MIMO. Bluetooth and these personal area networks also use some basic forms of spread spectrum. Okay, so the idea is that our channel encoder is going to produce a fairly narrow bandwidth signal, and we then use a modulator to spread the bandwidth of that signal. This gives us immunity to some noise and multipath fading, so essentially, again, if you have a narrow band signal, if it hits that deep fade, you've lost the entire signal. If you spread it out, then you're going to have sort of frequency selective fading, okay, which you have to be able to recover from. Okay. What we'll see beyond that is that if you're clever about it, the problem with going from it, the reason you'd want a narrowband signal is so you can squeeze more channels into a single bandwidth, or into the channel, the full channel bandwidth, but you want more sub-channels. So if you're spreading it out signal, and there's going to be less or no unique bandwidths or subchannels, and so we're going to have to be clever about how we do that spreading in order to still allow multiple users to use that spectrum. And so we started out with some sort of simple bit stream, and to that we add our spreading code, transmit this spread signal, and then at the other end we've got the spread signal. We can reapply the same code typically and and extract our original signal. Okay, so there's two ways of going about this. The first we're going to look at is frequency hopping spread spectrum, then the second will be direct sequence spread spectrum. And frequency hopping spread spectrum spreads the bandwidth by changing the base frequency or the carrier frequency of the signal at periodic intervals. Okay. So what we think of is that we can divide the channel into some number of carrier frequencies to form subchannels, okay, and there's got to be some sort of, we've got to be able to get our narrowband signal onto any of those subchannels, and then we when we transmit, we operate on one subchannel for a fixed period of time, and then we change our subchannel. Okay. Exactly how we're changing our subchannel is defined by a spreading code. Okay. And we'll see there are certain properties of the spreading code. We want it to look somewhat noise-like. We want it to truly spread the signal. So you start with a frequency shifted signal, then you combine that with our carrier frequency, our carrier signal, and that will give you a main mode plus a few side modes that we can filter. We transmit that filtered signal, and again at the other end we unwind that process. So we'll have a look at that in a sec. Okay. So our base signal is just going to be an FSK signal. And so we're transmitting at sort of two different frequencies, depending on whether you have a 1 or a 0 to transmit. And that will, of course, happen for the duration of the bit. So we have a bit period of T. Okay. Our carrier signal, again, is just transmitting at some carrier frequency, FI. So when you combine that you get a product of two cosines. And so we see that that's two components at the frequency of your base frequency plus your carrier frequency and then minus your carrier frequency. You can filter that to keep only the one
component. Okay. So you now have something that's being transmitted at this different carrier frequency. At the receiver end, again, we hit it with the carrier frequency,
and now what we want to do is keep the difference component. We can do that by filtering out the other component, and we recover our original signal,
admittedly at a reduced amplitude. Okay.
If you think about it, there's if you can do it for two frequencies, you can do it for multiple. You can do it for multiple original signal frequencies. So you can have an original MFSK modulation. So you can now represent 4 bits, 8 bits, 16 bits instead of your 2 bits, and again by applying our different carrier frequencies, we can shift exactly at what frequency we're transmitting our signal.
Okay. Okay. So you have two things going on then.
You have your the rate at which you're changing your signaling elements, and recall or the duration of your signaling elements. So, you just want over the rate, and then you have the rate at which you're changing your carrier frequency, or the duration then of the application of that carrier frequency, which is 1 over that rate. Okay. So we classify the spreading techniques according to the duration of our signaling element relative to the duration of, staying within a single carrier frequency. And so if your carrier frequency changes more slowly than your signaling element, so you have multiple signaling elements per change in carrier frequency, then this is referred to as slow frequency hop spread spectrum. And what does that mean? Well, it means that if you happen to be in a bad place with your carrier frequency, you're going to lose multiple signaling elements. The reverse, if you change your carrier frequency multiple times per the duration of the signaling element, then that's referred to as fast frequency hopping.
Okay. Now we'll look at an example, Mitchell. A picture is always worth 1,000 words. Okay. So, in this is an example of slow frequency hop spread spectrum.
So we're changing our carrier frequency every two signaling elements. We're using MFSK, so each signaling element is encoding 2 bits. Each signaling element is encoding 4 bits. Sorry, no change yet. Signaling 2 bits. Okay. So, I will rewind. We're encoding 2 bits per signal. For signaling element, and therefore we need 4 changes to the signaling element to encode those 2 bits. So that means that the changes to the signaling element are going to be contained within this band, a bandwidth of size WD. Now, when we change our carrier frequencies, we've got 4 different carrier frequencies, so we need 4 WD then. Okay, so we've changed the spectrum, the bandwidth of our signal from being WD to being 4 times WD or WS now. So, which portion of WS we're in is governed, which of these WD bands we're in is governed by our spreading code, which tells us which carrier frequency to use. Then within that, again, we have to move two different frequencies depending on what combination bits. So we start out, our first combination bits is 00. So that would be our lowest frequency. Our spreading code is 00, so that takes us into this first section with the lowest carrier frequency. During the duration of that carrier frequency, we move from sending bit 00 to sending bit 11, so that moves us up to the highest slot, but still within our single WD bandwidth. Okay. So then our spreading code changes, so we are now at if we go as frequency 0, we're at carrier frequency 2. So this portion of the spectrum. And within that, we're representing a 1-0, and then following that, a 1-1. Okay. We change our carrier frequency again. We're now in carrier frequency 3. And then within that, we're representing a 0-1 and a 1-0. Then we're back to, then we change our carrier frequency. We're at carrier frequency 1. Within that, we're representing 0-1, then a 1-1. Last change to carrier frequency 3. Within that, we're representing 1-0, then 0-0. So, again, what we can see is that we've spread our signaling from WD now up to WS.
Again, it's slow frequency hop spread spectrum because the carrier frequency is maintained over multiple signaling elements. In our second example, we have fast frequency hop spread spectrum. So, again, we're using MFSK with 2 bits per signaling element. And now our hop code is changing during the duration of our signaling element. Okay, so we're representing the start 0, 0, and we have 2 different carrier frequencies. You start in one and you change to the second. Okay. So you start down in carrier frequency 0, represent 0, 0. Halfway through the duration of that signaling element, you increase to carrier frequency 2. Okay. So carrier frequency 0, carrier frequency 2. So again, you can see the position within the WD is the same because you're representing the same signaling element. And so you keep going. Your second signaling element is 1, 1, so you're up at the top. And you've got 2 different carrier frequencies, the top one, then the next one down. Then 1, 0, so you're 1 from the top. And you start with 0 for your carrier frequency. Carrier frequency is at F0 up to carrier frequency F3. And you continue along that way. So again, 1, 1 is represented, and you hop during the transmission of that signal.
Is there any advantage of one over the other in terms of fast versus slow, or why would you want to implement that looks a bit more complex than our own?
Well, there's sometimes you do it like again with fast you'll get spreading sort of within individual elements, which may allow you to, again, recover them. If one band, say, is not good.
So faster, the better.
Yeah. But it is correct. It is harder to decode it then. Okay. Again, what we want overall is sort of a big increase in the spectrum or over which you're transmitting a signal. And the larger the value of the increase, the better the resistance to noise and jamming. So as an example, we'll look at what happens with signal jamming. Okay. And so we start with our narrowband signal, and we assume we have a fixed power SJ on the signal carrier frequency. Okay. We also assume that our jammer is fixed power. So, if we look at the signal-to-noise ratio, or the signal energy per bit, the noise power density, like we say is important for some and for loss and some of the other things, then um,
for your original signal. You've concentrated your signal power within this. You can concentrate the power within our
narrow bandwidth WD. Okay. If you then spread your signal, then the jammer, in order to jam, is going to have to, again, block all of the different WDs. So you are reducing the jamming power by the number of different carrier frequencies. Okay. And so the gain by that, again, is the ratio of your spread signal, your spread bandwidth, to the initial narrow bandwidth. Okay, so again, what that says is just that you're forcing the jammer to spread their efforts over a greater bandwidth. Okay, so that's one approach to spreading the bandwidth of the signal. A second approach is what's called direct sequence spread spectrum, and what direct sequence spread spectrum does is it essentially increases the bit rate. And so the bandwidth of signal is related to 1 over the duration of the signal. And so if you reduce the duration of the signal, then you're increasing the bandwidth. Now, having said that, the data rate is the data rate, so how do we increase the duration? Or, sorry, how do we increase the data rate? We do that by adding a code which splits your initial bit into a coded sequence of bits. Okay. So you then transmit that coded sequence, receive the coded sequence, and reapply your code to recover your original bit. Okay. So in this case, the code we're applying is 0110 to each bit. So if you have a 0, we said that everything stays the same, or you get the code. If you have our code is actually over multiple bits here. Okay, so the code, you give your code, you encode the data, then again, if you reapply the code, you'll end up extracting the data. Okay.
So here our code is 0110001, and then that, actually, sorry, I shouldn't. So we're jumping ahead. Okay, well, we have a code anyway, which actually doesn't look like it's repeating itself over this duration. So we have a code. As we apply the code to each sequence, and again, that involves exclusive ORing, which means that if you have two zeros and two ones, you get a zero. If you have 1011, you get a one. Okay. Transmit that, reapply the code with the exclusive ORing, and you recover the original sequence.
Okay. So we can think of this as a spread spectrum using binary phase shift keying. So we start with our signal, and so we can just say we're going to get plus or a minus to indicate the 0 or 1. And then we apply chipping sequence. And we can either apply it to the original data, and so you can combine the data plus a chipping stream, or you can combine the bits first and then modulate them. So we again start out with our original signal. We can modulate that signal. Then if we apply the spreading code, we see it's essentially we're getting sort of smaller bit representations. If you think of this now as a signaling element, again, we've reduced the duration, which is spreading out the
frequency bandwidth.
Okay, so again, you end up with resistance to jamming. We can assume that our jamming signal is centering around our carrier frequency. And so our received signal is going to be a combination of our original signal and our jamming signal. But now the spreader is going to multiply our received signal by our chipping code. And what that's going to do is spread the power over the whole frequency. Okay. But we're going to use a bandpass signal filter to get back to our narrowband signal. And again, that's going to remove elements of our jamming signal as well. Okay. So again, you get
improve a resistance to jamming, which is proportional to how far you have spread
your code. Okay. So that's the basic idea between, but you know, with spread spectrum is that you again you're spreading the range of frequencies of the signal. You're spreading the bandwidth of the signal, which allows us resistance to noise and jamming. But one thing that might hurt you, and which I mentioned earlier, is that obviously if you spread your signal over a greater range, then unless you do something, you're going to be fitting less signals into any given channel, you know, overall system bandwidth. So the question becomes then, how can you share out the system bandwidth among multiple users? Okay. So if we think of RWD was the original bandwidth of the signal, you can think of, well, let's say we spread that over the whole bandwidth, the whole system bandwidth, then WS. So you've gone from being able to transmit WS over WD signals to now being able to transmit one signal. Okay. But if you think about it, maybe you can be clever about your codes, so that the signals don't interfere or interfere in a recoverable fashion. If you think about frequency hop spread spectrum, so you've got these certain subchannels in use, but you know, there's no reason that if you're using this portion, this carrier frequency, there's no reason that some other signal can't use a different carrier frequency. Okay, so in that way, if you're clever about how you share things out, then you should be able to fit multiple users into the spectrum. And a similar thing will happen with our direct sequence spread spectrum. If we're clever about how we encode our signals, if we encode each signal differently, then we should be able to recover a particular signal out of multiple signals. Okay. So, we're going to think of our direct sequence spread spectrum setup. But now we're going to think of multiple users. So each user is signaling with the same data rate. And now we're going to, each user is going to encode their bits using K chips, so K subbits. And just for thinking about it, we're going to say that each of these codes can be thought of as a vector of length K. And so for each bit from each user,
if we use an I, then that bit's going to be represented by either plus or minus SI.
So obviously, we're going to have a different code for each user. And what we'd really like is for these codes to be what's called orthogonal. So if you combine any two codes, any two non-identical codes, then we would like the combination to be zero. Okay. So we'd like the codes to cancel each other out. So if we assume that, then for any given signal, for any given bit, we recover the bit as we did before by just applying our chipping code. If we apply our chipping code to somebody else's bit, then they'll cancel out and we should be able to recognize that that's not, that signal is not for us. You don't need complete orthogonality to do that. You can frequently, that you need sort of good enough orthogonality. You need them to be sort of far enough away from each other. Okay, so if we go through an example of this, we have three users.
Okay. Now each of these users has a different code. So user A is 1, minus 1, minus 1, 1, minus 1, 1. User B is 1, 1, minus 1, minus 1, 1, 1. User C is 1, 1, minus 1, 1, 1, minus 1. So for any given user, again, the codes are your 1s and 0s just give you plus and minus of the code. So for user A, that's plus the code, plus the code, minus the code, plus the code. Same thing for user B, so plus, plus with it, with minus, and plus again. Okay, and user C, the same thing. Plus, plus, minus, plus. Okay. So if we examine our codes, excuse me, then CA is orthogonal to both B and C. So you get 1, minus 1 is 0, plus 1, minus 1, minus 1, plus 1. So if you apply CA and CB together, you get 0. If you apply CA and CC together, you get 0. CB and CC aren't orthogonal, so you'll get 1, 2, 3, 2, 3, 2, so CB and CC are not orthogonal. Okay. Okay. So if we look again at transmitting a single bit, then, you know, again, you transmit either plus or minus your code. And if we try to recover the bit using, we use our code again, and we see we'll either get 6 or minus 6. Okay, so you either get the length of the code or minus So that's, we can easily distinguish between the two bits. if some small portion of this is changed in transmission, we can still distinguish. If we get any value other than plus or minus 6 in this case, so plus or minus the length of the code, you know that there's been some error, or someone else is transmitting with a non-orthogonal code. But again, what you hope is that the value would still be largely positive or largely negative, and you'll be able to interpret your original bit.
Okay. So again,
if we look at orthogonal codes, then if both A and B are transmitting, then the receiver, again, is going to receive a combination of the two signals. But, say we look at A, the receiver for A, the receiver for A will apply A's code, when it's applied to its own signal. Again, you're going to recover the signal. When it's applied to somebody else's signal that's within orthogonal code, E0 that. So you end up with your original
signal back, or an interpretation of your original signal. Okay. If you try to do that, again, with non-orthogonal codes,
then it won't work quite as well. So we can look at B and C now sending messages. So B and C are not orthogonal to each other. And so, again, at the receiver, we'll get a combination of the two codes. A combination of the two encoded signals. If we apply B's code, again, we don't get 6, but we get 4. And we say, well, that's still largely positive, so we're going to interpret that as a 1. If we apply C's code, we get minus 4. And again, we say it's not the minus 6 that we would expected, but it's still largely negative, so we're going to interpret that as a 0.
Okay. So,
CDMA is sensitive to multipath effects. In particular, the delay can be problematic. Again, if one problem you increase the bit rate, your bit durations are smaller, so delays become problematic. So typically, the receivers used will have to account for delays. So they will try and determine the dominant path, the dominant multipaths, estimate the delay of the signal along those paths, and then correct for that delay factor. Then we can also compensate for variances in received power as well. Okay. So we take the multiple copies that we're receiving and we try and form up one coherent copy from that.
Okay. Additionally, CDMA is sensitive to what's called a near-far problem. So in our examples, we assumed that our signals were essentially that we were receiving from different sources were essentially the same strength, but if you think about, again, having a single receiver and multiple users spread around at different distances, if they all transmit at the same power, then the power at which the receiver receives the signal is not going to be the same. Okay. If a user is close to the receiver, relatively high power. If the user is far away from the receiver, you get lower power. And if you think of this in conjunction with trying to extract the original signal, then the combined signal is going to be dominated by sort of the higher power receptions, and therefore you will not necessarily get be able to extract the appropriate signal for all users. Okay. Now, typically, to solve that problem, you use what's called the channel inversion technique. And so what this says is that users should transmit at different power levels depending on where they are. The farther away you are from the base station, to the lower power you're receiving at, then the higher power you transmit at, so that hopefully at the base station again things will receive at the same power level. Okay. This can have implications if you have sort of multiple base stations. This can have implications because you're also going to be sort of interfering with base stations that are not necessarily in communication. Okay. So, just to wrap up our discussion of spread spectrum, we're going to say a little bit about how you pick the spreading codes and the characteristics that we want. We'd like them to be noise-like, which means that their mean should be approximately zero, so you should be alternating between zeros and ones. We don't want repeating patterns. So that's just for sort of ideal spreading and ideal, again, ideal encoding. Additionally, again, if we're sort of sharing with other users, which in most cases we will be, then we need orthogonality or near orthogonality. And so there's multiple ways then of generating these sequences. We'll look at a couple of them. PN sequences don't necessarily guarantee orthogonality, but they're harder for a user to predict. They're harder for an observer to encode. There's ways of directly constructing orthogonal codes, which are
quite straightforward and orthogonal, but don't give you much good encoding in the sense that an observer will
sort of pretty immediately be able to determine what your code is. So our first class of codes, PN codes, well, they have to be generated somehow, and so anything which we generate algorithmically will eventually repeat, but we want it to then appear to be random. Properties that we require is that we would like, again, it to look as random as possible, and so things like we'd like a uniform distribution, so with a balanced property, so again, an average of about half ones and half zeros, so if you think of that as being plus and minus them, averaging to zero. And we don't want long sequences of either ones or zeros. We would like, again, an observer not to be able to infer much about the sequence from previous observations. Okay. And we would also like, if we shift our sequence, that it's essentially fairly orthogonal with the original sequence. Okay, so again, what that's doing is it's giving you a very a nice random sequence. Again, that can be used for not just spreading purposes, but also sort of encoding, encryption sort of purposes as well. So these sorts of sequences are typically produced using linear feedback shift registers. And so again, depending on how clever you are in picking your arrangement, they can have quite long sequences without sort of quite long periods, so sequences without repetition. Okay, so the basic idea is that you're going to produce any new output as a combination of sort of historical values and the generator is going to be the sum under exclusive ORing of, again, a bunch of historical values. So you either, you can change it by either adding that value in or not. Okay. It's sort of similar to have cyclic redundancy codes, etc., working like this. These are coefficients of a generator polynomial. Depending on what that polynomial is, again, you get better or worse results for your sequence. Okay. So you have your generator, and then, of course, you have to have some initial conditions, so what's your original collection of bits to start you off? Okay.
And without proving anything, we can assert that the output for the LFSR is periodic. The maximum period is 2dn-1. There's always some configuration which will give you that maximum period. Okay. You're never going to get a run of all zeros unless you sort of start out with all zeros. And so our desired sequences are our maximal length or M sequences, where we get the maximum period. Being able to achieve that depends on, again, how you pick your generator. So, just looking at one example, we start, we have to start out in some initial state. And then the new bit that we generate is just going to be B0 plus B1, or exclusive OR B1, and of course our output is B0. So we start out in our initial state, and then again we get our new bit and we shift everything down. So B3 goes to B2, B2 goes to B1, B1 goes to B0, B0 plus B1 or exclusive OR with B1 goes to B3. Okay. So given that, again, we can calculate what our new B3 is going to be. B0 exclusive OR with B1. We'll go to our new B3, shift everything else down. Our output is again B0. Okay. So here we finally get B0 plus B1 is something different to 1. Our output is B0 still. We shift the 1 with B3, shift everybody else down, and we keep going in that fashion. And we see that we go from 0 to 14 without a repetition in state. When we reach 15, we're back to our initial state. So that means that our period is the maximal period. We have 4, 2 to the 4 minus 1 is 15. We've produced 4, this very short, small number, and we've produced our maximal sequence.
Okay. Now, again, stated without any proof whatsoever, M sequences have a lot of these properties that we're looking for. We have roughly the same number of zeros and ones. The second one just says it's periodic. And then, again, it does have a good distribution of zeros and ones and runs of zeros and ones, so you're not getting long runs of zeros or long runs of ones. Okay. So obviously it's correlated
with itself, but if you shift the sequence and look at the correlation with the shifted version, then you know, there's a very low correlation. Okay. What that means is that you produce near, if you take shifted versions, that you're going to have near orthogonal sequences. Okay, so if it's not considered, these codes are, you know, you can, are good for seeing the general go about producing them. They're not considered good enough to, for use, and so more complicated generators are typically used. Basically, they're combinations of these simple generators. Okay. So those codes, again, they're nice because they produce things that to an observer appear very random. If you're not as worried about what observers are seeing in terms of randomness, another option is to directly generate orthogonal codes. Okay. So just construct them. And again, that's handy because you know, for the recovery of the signal. The most common way of generating, directly generating an orthogonal code is to use what's called the Walsh codes. And you generate codes of a given length recursively, starting with no code at all, essentially, and then building up what's called a Walsh matrix. And you build up that Walsh matrix by taking the previous matrix and producing a 2n by 2n version of it by putting in wn, 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 and then the converse of WN. Okay. So all rows are orthogonal to all other rows, and naturally the knots of all other rows. One drawback is that the cross-correlation between the code and shifted version is not zero. Okay. It's not even close to zero, so you have to make sure that your systems are highly synchronized. Okay. And so here's an example of, again, generating your Walsh matrices. So you start with 0.0, and so your next matrix, of course, is 0, 0, 0, 1. And then you replicate that 3 times and then replicate the converse in the corner and keep on doing that. So again, if you were to pick out any 2 rows, they would be orthogonal to each other. Another handy feature of these codes is that we can use then variable length codes to allow the users to run at different rates.
So essentially, if a user is running at a slower rate, you have a faster rate code. Since the overall sending rate is going to be the rate of the code times the user, you can even out differences in user rates. So if we assume there's some minimum rate, and then other data rates are multiple powers of two relative to that minimum rate, then we can again look at having a spreading sequence 2^n for our minimal rate. As an example, then, if some other user is generating data at twice the rate, well, we can give them half the length code. Okay. If you give them half the length code, then the rate will end up being the same. So if you again look at the Walsh codes, then Walsh codes of different dimensions also demonstrate these orthogonality
properties, so you will be okay using the different codes. Okay. So to wrap up,
spread spectrum techniques provide immunity to fading and jamming, and they're relatively simple to implement. We can use the spreading codes to allow multiple users to run within the same spectrum. But we do get that there are issues, sensitivity to multi-path, the complexity of the decoding, etc. So these were quite popular in 3G systems and older Wi-Fi systems, but there sort of were limits to, again, the data rates that you could push the systems to, and the spectrum efficiency for these sorts of systems.
Newer systems have moved to the techniques of orthogonal frequency division multiplexing,
and this is combined with multiple input, multiple output
methods of either providing redundancy or multiplexing within your spectrum. So we'll take a break now, and when we return, we'll say something
about, again, OFDM and MIMO, and you teach the guts of the class on them, but we'll just sort of try and see basically how they work and what properties they have.
So again, we'll take our usual 15-20 minute break.